I'm going to acknowledge my co-workers first, Dr. Irbelding, who's sitting in the audience, as well as Drs. McCall and Pat Santora. So I'm actually going to begin with the purpose rather than the background. And the purpose of our study was to investigate the relationship between binge drinking, which is defined as five or more drinks on one occasion, and the relationship between that and risky sexual behaviors and STDs by gender in an urban STD clinic. Now, it almost seems axiomatic that heavy drinking is associated with risky sexual behaviors. I think we sort of take that for granted in our society. And yet, if you look at the actual studies, either the definition of heavy alcohol use or the outcome is missing a biomarker. So there haven't been a lot of studies that have looked at a well-defined, a good definition of heavy alcohol use and an actually well-defined outcome, an STD biomarker. But there are a couple studies, and so we do know that correlation exists. We also know there's been one study that was done by Cook and Clark looking at adolescent urban STD clinic patients and found high rates of heavy alcohol use in STDs. But there aren't a lot of studies in STD clinics, which seems sort of like a no-brainer because you've got high-risk behaviors, and if you can identify some of the risk factors that go with those high-risk behaviors, it would suggest an avenue for prevention. One of the other interests that we had was to look at the role of gender. And although we have this binge drinking, high-risk sexual behavior connection, looking at what it means for men versus what it means for women has not been done, either in an STD clinic or more generally. So that was the other purpose of our study. We approached 795 consecutive admissions to the Baltimore City Health Department's STD clinic. 675 patients agreed to participate. We did oversample for females, which is why we have 52%. 95% of our sample is African American. That's the neighborhood in which we live. 73% were never married. 83% were heterosexual. And 77% had partial or high school GED. All the patients, as part of their routine visit, were tested for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. And then we assessed their alcohol use and their drug use and their sexual behaviors in the last 30 days. We used the risk behavior assessment from NIDA and the audio CASI, which we had found from previous studies. People tend to be more self-disclosing on the audio CASI than they are in interview, face-to-face interview. So based on alcohol use of the last 30 days, we divided people, men and women, into three independent groups. So either you had no alcohol use in the last 30 days, you drank but you didn't binge, didn't have those five drinks, or you had five or more drinks on one occasion. And then we looked at the association between alcohol use group and the sexual risk behaviors. We know that age is associated with binge drinking, as is employment status and drug use. We know that from national figures as well as what we looked at in our own study. So we adjusted for those. What we found is that 30% of the women reported binge drinking. Now, this is higher than national estimates, and this is a somewhat older sample as well, because it won't surprise you that binge drinking is more common amongst young people. 32% of our women drank alcohol but didn't binge, and 38% abstained. Now, interestingly, the women binge drinkers had higher rates of drug use, and by drug use, I mean marijuana, heroin and cocaine, but it was not related to sexual behaviors or STDs. And if you look at different samples, sometimes you find that correlation. Some of our co-presenters today did find that correlation, but we didn't. And that's compared to women who didn't binge or abstain from alcohol. The men also had high rates of binge drinking, but not quite as high compared to national averages. 24% drank alcohol but didn't binge, and 34% abstained from alcohol. Once again, the men bingers were like the women. They had higher rates of drug use, but this was not related to sexual behaviors or STDs. This is not a population that has high rates of, at least reportedly, high rates of heroin and cocaine. Alcohol is really the drug of choice at the STD clinic. Now, I should go back. One other point about the men before I talk about the women. Contrary to our expectation, binge drinking was not associated in the men with any sexual risk behaviors or STDs. This was not what we predicted. Our best estimate is that the sexual risk behaviors of the men were so high across all the three groups that it was actually difficult to detect whether binge drinking had any influence or had any association with risk behaviors. But as you can see with the women, that tells a quite a different story. Oral sex, not a risky sexual behavior, but oral sex was correlated with binge drinking. The binge drinkers, as well as the women who drank alcohol, were more likely to engage in oral sex in the last 30 days than women who abstained from alcohol. One word in terms of the measurements, these were all either you engaged or you did not engage in oral sex, vaginal sex, unprotected sex. Multiple sex partners were defined as either having one partner or two or more partners. Vaginal sex for women was high across the board, was no association with binge drinking. Unprotected sex, again, high across the board, no surprise, this is an STD clinic. What is interesting is the rates of anal sex, which seems to be sort of the theme this morning, rates of our binge drinkers were 33%, which is very high, and as you can see, is three times the rate of women who abstained from alcohol and about twice the rate of women who drank alcohol. Similarly, for multiple sex partners, the women who binged had more sexual partners compared to women who did not drink alcohol. What I think always the picture tells a thousand words, I think this is a sort of clear graphic. You can see for the men that anal sex is high across all three groups. It shows no association with alcohol, but you can very clearly see the association of binge drinking with engagement in anal sex in the last 30 days. I think that just tells a prettier picture. And for gonorrhea, we looked at, as I said, gonorrhea, syphilis, and chlamydia. Our numbers of syphilis were not that high, so I think that might have been an issue of power. Chlamydia was in the expected direction, with binge drinkers being higher than non-binge drinkers. But gonorrhea, as you can see, once again, with the men, it's high across all groups, so you can't detect the association. But with women, binge drinking is at, I didn't put the numbers at the top of the bars, but binge drinking women with gonorrhea was about 11.2% compared to about 2.2% of women who abstained from alcohol. So you have almost five times the rate of gonorrhea amongst women who are binge drinkers compared to women who didn't binge. So, summary of our findings. There's high rates of binge drinking at the STD clinic. This suggests an obvious avenue for some intervention for those of us like myself who come from the substance abuse background. Women binge drinkers have at least twice the rate of anal sex and multiple sex partners and five times the rate of gonorrhea compared to their non-binge drinking and non-drinking counterparts. What I think is really interesting, again going back to the anal sex theme, is that this is a very, our rate that we found amongst the binge drinkers is nearly double the rate reported by, there's a study by Satterwhite in 2007 looking at the increase in anal sex over the last 5 years from three STD clinics, the New Jersey, Colorado, and California. They found 18%, and I think that was over 90 days. Our window is 30 days. So we have very high rates here, and there are, I think, a couple reasons for that. I work in an HIV clinic, and talking to my patients there, although I did not sample the patients at the STD clinic, some women believe that there's a lower risk, obviously there's no risk of pregnancy, but a lower risk of STD transmission. But my other current theory is it's the influence of the internet, pornographic websites which show anal sex and plants the idea in mind. There's also the possibility of sex for drug exchanges as well. So I think there are multiple reasons. But I do think the internet, and I haven't seen this quite, this hypothesis tested, but I think that is having an influence. So what are we to conclude? Again, this is a Satterwhite study that anal sex has increased, more than doubled in the last 5 years. We don't have this data from our STD clinic yet, but it would be interesting to know. Question, I have 5 minutes. Okay, thank you. We know that the rates nationwide of binge drinking are increasing, and rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia are increasing amongst women. And so you have an intersection in this STD clinic of two serious health consequences, health problems, especially for women. And we know from our research that women have greater long-term negative consequences from binge drinking as well as from STDs. So it's a call to action for women. And what we want to recommend is that we have routine screening for alcohol use. And this goes along with the recommendations as earlier this morning, that you want to combine your efforts to jointly reduce binge drinking, drug use, and risky sexual behaviors, because they're obviously connected. Now, we haven't done a cause and effect study, so I can't prove that for you yet, but we do know that the two behaviors co-occur. And I'm going to make the call again. Others have made this call before me, but we need interventions that are specifically targeted to women. It's women's reasons for engaging in risky sex are different. Their reasons for not changing their into more protective behaviors are different. And I think we've got to make a change here. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay, we are going to open the floor up to questions. I wonder if it would be helpful to ask the speakers to come up on the podium and then take questions up here. If you could bring a chair with you, because there's only two up here now, but then we could have all six presenters come up and then take questions from the audience. Start things going. I was very interested in the respondent-driven sampling and the snowball sampling, and I'm wondering if those are similar. To what extent did you see similarities in the description of the mixed study as with your study in Boston?
Okay. Well, the question just is asking me in terms of respondent-driven sampling versus simply snowball sampling. Is this on? I don't know if you could. Can you hear me? I didn't think so. Hello. Okay, so I'll just talk loud. Basically, respondent-driven sampling is a kind of chain referral sampling method that is derived from snowball sampling, which is a snowball sampling is a non-probability sampling strategy, meaning that any results that you get cannot be generalizable to your population. It's a convenience sample. And RDS is conceivably RDS. RDS can derive population estimates if it follows those conditions that I tried to outline. For our purposes, it was a convenience sample. And it's a little bit, that was different, the way we applied it was a little different from a traditional snowball sampling in that we had we limited the number of recruits, meaning that we only limited to 3 recruits per, and in a snowball chain, what you can do is you just say, hi, sir, will you go out and refer your friends into this study, or will you give me the names of the people who then I can contact to enroll into this study? That's traditional snowball. And so RDS is, like I said, on following conditions is different, and for our purposes, it was different even from that because it was a convenient sample. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Condom use in our sample. And sadly, we didn't get, only about 50% of those were answered, so we really weren't able to look at that. You know, this was a new intake form, and so basically the variables we used were ones that were consistently filled out. So our next iteration, we're going to sit down with our interviewers and make them, you know, be a little more careful about that. That and recent SME history, we also didn't want to look back.
Right in the back.
So the question was the same, did we look at unprotected, whether people use protection during annual intercourse? And the answer is yes, we did. For each act of sex, including oral sex, we asked also if they used protection. And in the slide, I just combined all the acts of unprotected intercourse to get a total percent. And the rates were so high of protection, somewhere around 89%. It didn't differ between vaginal and anal. So basically, they just weren't using protection. About 9%. The question was, how did we ask the questions about alcohol use in the clinic?
Well, how was the uptake among your interviewers to kind of add that to their cachet of things that you were doing?
So, well, this study, we used the audio passive. So patients, if they agreed to be part of the study, put on the headphones, sat in front of the computer, and answered the questions. I think, so, it was, they answered the questions about alcohol along with drug use and sexual behaviors. We recruited 790 people and 671 agreed to participate, so I think the uptake was pretty good. Does that answer your question?
Just among the people working on the study and integrating that into the clinic as a routine practice.
What do I see for the future?
Or just acceptable to the people doing the work?
Well, you know what, actually I'm going to have my colleague who runs the STD clinic answer that question as to how acceptable she is.
This research data collection is separate from usual clinic flow, and then drinking has not been incorporated into that risk interview. I think we struggle with resource issues, and also it's hard to ask, it's hard to get the best questions to ask because it's, you know, it's a variable. I don't think research was really on that.
Well, I think probably if you wanted to ask the questions about alcohol, are you familiar with the audit? The alcohol use, right, and ask the first three questions of the audit, that would be the easiest way to.
Question in the very back. Against the wall.
As far as I knew, the cases that occur actually on military posts are reported to the State Health Department, which in turn are reported to CDC. So is that... Right. 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 Absolutely. There are obviously a lot of things to be done as far as STIs and prevention in the military, but Dr. Gatos actually wrote an editorial recently in 2008 where one of the recommendations was that there needs to be a better collaboration between the civilian and the military population. I mean, they're not quite separated. We all mix together, so... I'm not sure about the policy when they leave. I get the sense that they don't get screened. But as far as the data, we just looked at active duty because we do have data on reserve and guard service members, but because they can access, well, actually anyone can access, but they tend to access care outside of the military healthcare system, we have no visibility of that.
That's actually a very, yes, the question was about equilibrium, and that's one of the major claims of respondent-driven sampling is that it's the point at which equilibrium where that you can then make these population estimates that would then allow you to do something like a report with some validity around your surveillance data. And that's actually, I am not that familiar with how that is achieved, and that is something that I don't see explicated very clearly in the literature, to be honest with you. What I did read in a recent article from 2008 is that equilibrium is calculated prior to your sampling, and how that is done, that's I don't know how that's done. So meaning that I have not yet seen that explained prior to, other than the fact that one thing that they imply in the literature is that after about 4 to 6 recruitment waves, that you begin to see the achievement of equilibrium. And I think that with that, what I want to say about the prior, not the prior calculation part, but the as you sample part, the idea is that if you were to sample and you begin to see this consistency of your population, and so over a certain number of waves, given some robust recruitment turnover, that you'll start to see some consistency in the people that you are getting, and that's a point at which you start to see some redundancy, and so you could then argue that that is equilibrium. So I think that that was original in the claims of where equilibrium is derived, and but I'd like to learn more about that as well. Oh, well, we actually went to about, I mean, technically we went to about 14 waves, but in that 14 waves, it wasn't 14 waves across all of the entire sample, meaning all 10 seeds did not recruit at the same rate. Those 14 waves were only within one seed, then leading to a 14-wave recruits. But that's a claim for where you can get a population estimate is when you have very robust recruitment happening across a number of your seeds, or you have robust recruitment happening within one or two seeds, but tapping into diverse populations or diverse subpopulations. That's a very good question, and I believe that we had the way our research institute works with our study participants is that we engage our providers, and that might mean that we specifically have a provider then making research studies known to our patients, or that we'll post a flyer, and so a patient may come into an examination room and then see a posted flyer. For this particular, and then other times actually we'll have an independent staff person attached to this specific study actually waiting to engage a patient given their given that permission. So the provider might see the patient and then say, we have a study and someone would like to talk to you about that. Would you be interested in talking with that person? And that's how they're engaged. For this particular study, let me just ask Matthew. Matthew, for this study, was it a flyer like in the examination rooms? Okay. Thanks.
I'm told we have to end discussion right now, but I'm sure that the speakers would be happy to answer questions. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and have a good day.